Hi there, my name is Muhammad, and I'm the host of the Reconfigured Podcast, a show that explores the intersection of technology, culture, and society. We bring professionals to talk about their extended experience or discuss about a specific topic that might interest the audience. All of our episodes are available for free, with no cost to the general public. Just a quick reminder that we are always on the lookout for interesting guests who can share their unique perspective on the topics we cover, or you can pitch in a new topic to discuss on the pod. Just reach out to us on social media or apply to our available opportunities posted on Polywork. So welcome to the show. Today I'm with John. John, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm John Gottfried, one of the co-founders of Major League Hacking. It's really good to be here.
Yeah. So as a co-founder, what have been the most rewarding aspect of building and growing MLH over the years?
So when you start a company, there's a lot of ups and downs, and it really is an accelerated learning curve. Like when I started out at MLH, I had only ever worked as a software engineer before or a developer evangelist. And, you know, when you start a business, you're exposed to all these other things: sales, marketing, finance, HR, and you're forced to learn them really, really quickly. And so that's been incredibly rewarding from a professional development standpoint, is, you know, learning a lot of interesting things really quickly. But for MLH specifically, because we're an impact-focused organization and actually a public benefit corp, probably the most rewarding thing about working on this for, you know, the last 10 years now is the impact that we have on people's lives. Like, we work with hundreds of thousands of people, mostly in college, who are starting off their careers and really trying to find their footing in the tech world. And 40% of them say that, you know, participating in MLH programs changed their lives, which is a massive statement for someone to make. And that makes all of the crazy stuff you have to deal with as a startup founder 100% worth it, is knowing that we had a positive impact on people.
So how has MLH played a role in documenting the stories of student hackers and the broader tech community? So you now said that the MLH has helped people accelerate through. Can you share any memorable stories or experiences you've been captured through MLH initiatives?
Yeah, I mean, every year we actually put out a list of our top 50 hackers, which is not necessarily like the top 50, you know, best hackers, but rather the 50 people in our community who we think did something exceptional over the last year. Maybe they were an exceptional mentor. Maybe they organized a new community. Maybe they built a lot of really innovative projects. It's a pretty good mix of people. And so there's a lot of really compelling stories there. I think that for us, you know, when we think about amplifying stories, one of the most important parts of it is, you know, representation and showing a lot of different paths into this field. You know, for a lot of people, especially folks who are, you know, from groups that are not well represented in tech, seeing people like them as an aspirational path is incredibly important. And so we put a lot of our effort in telling stories around showing a diversity of backgrounds, of paths, of ways to sort of start out and get into tech and you know, find success, whatever that means for you. Like, I know, you know, anecdotally, like, there was a young woman many years ago who I met at her first hackathon ever. And I remember her being super intimidated because she was like an art student or a biology student. It was like something that was totally not computer science-y. And, you know, she came in and wanted to do an Arduino project. And this was a big hackathon. I think it was, you know, 1,000 people or something like that. And that's a kind of intimidating environment. But I remember her sitting down and starting to tinker with this Arduino. And at some point, she just kind of like stood up and looked around and was like, hey, can anyone help me figure out this Arduino? And a ton of people came to help. You know, like they paused their own projects and they went over to help her learn the ropes. And by the end of the event, she had created this really cool interactive painting that had all these LEDs that lit up, and it was controlled by Arduino, and it was one of the most popular projects anyone had demoed at that event. And I just remember it being this like really incredible light bulb moment where she went from, I don't know how to do any of this, to, I got support and people helped me learn, and I built something really impressive in a really short period of time. And, you know, after that, I saw her all the time at different hackathons because, you know, she unlocked something in herself that she didn't realize she was capable of.
So it's those small things where you have this kind of like self-doubt that I might not be good enough to do this. Then she broke this barrier and she got into it.
It's a small thing when you think about it in the context of 100,000 people. It's a really big thing for those individuals experiencing it.
Yeah. So MLH focuses on empowering student hackers, similar to this person that you've mentioned. How have you witnessed MLH impact on the career of participant, and what advice would you give to individuals looking to leverage their skills to excel in their careers?
Yeah. So when we think about how MLH can like shape people's careers, a big part of it comes from how we view most computer science education. The average computer science classroom is teaching you a lot of theory, right? Like, how do algorithms work? You know, how does programming work? How do you do something a certain way? Maybe what's the mathematics behind it? But they don't really teach you a lot of practical application, right? It's pretty rare in computer science degrees to work on a real world production level project, unless you're lucky enough to have an internship. And so, you know, we see ourselves as bridging that gap and giving people opportunities to build production level real projects that allow them to solve like actual problems that they're, you know, thinking about in the world. And that skill set is incredibly important when you're going to apply for jobs, because what happens is, you know, you go apply for an internship and they get hundreds or thousands of applications that all might have the same computer science classes on them. You know, they're not very easy to differentiate. And having projects where you've said, hey, I identified this problem, I created a solution for it, I thought through everything from what I wanted my solution to look like to what frameworks do I want to use, what database do I want to use, you know, how do users interact with it? Like, all of those are problems you face in a real job, and going to hackathons or our fellowship programs or any kind of self-driven project allows you to actually think through those problems and build those practical skills. And that, you know, frankly, does differentiate you from other applicants for internships and jobs. It gives you something to talk about. It builds expertise, and it looks different when you're actually applying.
Other than that, it's like when you're hiring someone, let's say an intern, your expectations is to hire someone who has a decent amount of experience, or they might know what they're doing, because if you want to hire them as an employee, you would rather have the person who knows what they're doing to get the job than trying to teach someone to learn the job. You understand?
That's one of those things that's like perhaps one of the more like hypocritical parts of tech hiring, is that I think companies perhaps expect too much of new hires. Given that there are not a lot of opportunities to learn these professional skills, I think that companies should be more willing to teach people on the job and help them get up to speed, because someone who is passionate and talented about technology can learn really quickly. And assuming that they have all of the skills they need before hiring them is, you know, not a realistic expectation.
So in your experience, how has MLH contributed to bridging the gap between technology and culture? And how does the organization foster a sense of inclusivity and diversity within the tech community? So you've mentioned before there's people who come from unrecognized groups. How would you be able to provide a medium that includes them in a diverse way?
Yeah, so a lot of it goes into event and community design. When you think about a community, right, like a student hacker community, for example, which is what we primarily work with, it is as much a professional community as it is a social community. And in a social community, you know, you have to feel comfortable to be successful and want to keep coming back. The main way that people go to their first meetup or hackathon is because a friend invited them. That does help with that initial comfort level. because you have someone to anchor you, right, and you know, help you get integrated. Once you pass that initial hurdle of deciding to show up, which is a big hurdle for a lot of people, then you start talking about event and community design. Like, what are the organizers, the people in leadership positions, doing to make it feel like a good space? There's a lot of things that go into this. Who do you show on your website, right? Like, what do the people look like? Can you identify with them? What language do you use? Is it hyper-competitive or is it inclusive and welcoming of people of all skill levels? When you show up for the event, are people friendly? You know, are they open to newcomers? Are they willing to give you guidance? When you sit down at the hackathon, you know, what happens? Are you talking about workshops and ways people can learn? Are you talking about, you know, how to access mentorship and support mechanisms? Are you talking about what the goals are of the event? You know, there's a huge difference in showing up and hearing that the goal is to win versus the goal is to just like have fun and learn something new, which I think is the real, you know, purpose most people go to hackathons. And so all of those like really detailed, nuanced things are what make a community inclusive and welcoming. Once you get, you know, past all of those, you have to start thinking about like sort of like reactive mechanisms as well, right? Like, do you have a code of conduct? Do you have a standardized response process for if there are code of conduct violations? You know, one of the things MLH does is, you know, we work with hundreds of events all organized by local student chapters on campus. You know, we provide them with a standardized code of conduct and people who are trained to respond to incidents. And that makes a huge difference in comfort level because you know that organizers care about it. It's a priority. And they've thought about what actually happens if something does not go as planned. And so, you know, these are just perhaps the tip of the iceberg in terms of how you design inclusive spaces at events. But like, there's an art to it. There's a science to it. There's a lot of research that's been done in this area. And you really do have to think about it from like that first impression of going to the website all the way through, you know, how does someone feel and what are the support mechanisms like at your space when they show up?
So it's much more than just, I want to organize an event and just make it friendly as much as possible. There's a lot of things that has to go under the hood on a psychological term, if you want to say, to make it feel more welcoming to people, even if they're not from a high level. But yeah, wouldn't, if let's say, for example, if you're doing something that's like low level or entry level, wouldn't this also make the higher level people just feel like it's not the event for them? Like, you might see some people who are high level, they want to meet with some people, and then they come to an event that they say like it's an introductory or it's like a simple event. They might say it's like, oh, that's not my thing. Maybe they might provide mentoring advice for people who are starting out, but they might feel that this is not the event for them.
It's possible people will feel that way, and that's okay. I think that that doesn't happen as much as you would expect in reality. I think of hackathons like a marathon. If you're going to run a marathon, there is a wide spectrum of ability levels and, you know, times that it takes you to finish, right? Like, are you going to be the super fast person who sets a new world record? Or is it an accomplishment just to finish? You know, for a lot of people at a hackathon, the accomplishment is finishing a project. And I think that those different skill levels and motivations can coexist in the same event format. You know, if you're a new person building your first project, it can be really inspiring to see a more experienced person building something really impressive, as long as that impressive project and level of competition doesn't hinder your own experience, right? Like, it's this model of like collaborative competition where like, maybe I do want to build something really great and win, but I don't want to do that in a way that's going to harm other people at the event that are just there to learn something. And we really work hard to foster that kind of environment and make sure that people understand, like, it's okay to want to win. It's okay to build something really big and impressive, but that's your motivation. You have to be respectful of other people's motivations, which might be, you know, just to finish.
Yeah, I remember when I used to go to hackathons, like the first hackathon is like, I want to win. It's like you get this idea, it's like, I want to be number one. And then later on, you'd be like, I'm just there to see people and have fun. Like, it's just about seeing people, enjoying time. It's even if I won, like 2 or 3 days later, people will forget about what happened. And it's like, if you won the first place, or if you won second, or if you won third, the most important thing about it is like the people if you met there. Because if you're going to sit down and focus on being the number one, you might miss out on opportunity, meeting someone who might be, let's say, your co-founder later on. You might meet with someone who might be, your, let's say, your next hire, or you might meet with someone who might help you on something rather than focusing on being number one.
100%. You're absolutely right. And like, I even remember back to my first hackathon, the project I built barely worked, you know, and like, I was kind of embarrassed to demo it because it was so janky. But even though it was like only semi-functional, I had people coming up to me afterwards saying like, wow, I love your idea. Like, I thought that was so cool. Like, what are you doing next? And to me, I was like, wow, all these really smart people, you know, think I did something cool. I thought it was kind of, you know, not great, but like they thought it was really cool. And that kept me coming back. And I think a lot of people have that same experience where like, even if their project is somewhat introductory, there's always going to be someone who thinks it's really cool.
Yep. Can you discuss some of the challenges that aspiring software developers face when transitioning to become a technical founder? So what resources or guidance does MLH provide to help those individuals navigate this path?
Honestly, we don't have a ton of resources for people who want to become founders. Partially because there's a lot of really good resources out there already, right? Like Startup School and things like that have a ton, like a massive library of content around what it's like to be a founder. I think that from my personal experience, when you're a software engineer working at a company, you're not always involved in the business strategy or the market problems that your company is facing. You know, you are given a scope, maybe you're involved in setting that scope, maybe not, but like, you're not necessarily the one who, you know, your efforts will make or break the company's business model, right? We have not put a ton of time into building resources for people to become founders because there's already a lot of great content out there, like things like Startup School or, you know, anything that Y Combinator puts out is pretty good. From my personal experience, the biggest challenge of transitioning from like a software engineer or a developer evangelist to a founder is that suddenly everything rests on your shoulders. You know, as an engineer, you're somewhat isolated from a lot of the bigger business decisions and revenue opportunities that companies face. You know, it's not up to you to figure out like, is your market big enough? Or, you know, is your product going to result in more revenue? Like, someone else at the company is usually responsible for that if you're just an engineer. As a founder, the buck stops with you, right? And so if I decide, like, I want to launch a new product and, you know, I'm going to have our engineering team work on it or whatever else, you know, I also have to figure out, especially in the early days of a startup, is that product a good idea? Is it going to resonate with the market? Are people going to buy it? You know, all of those different things are things that you suddenly have to start thinking about. And a lot of founders, especially those from technical backgrounds, I think struggle with making that transition from writing good code and good software to empathizing with customers and understanding their problems, because there are really, you know, different skill sets.
I just realized also some software devs will just create software for other developers to use much more than just fitting a business perspective. So I realized like some of them shift towards like B2B. So instead of focusing on creating something that works with clients, as in regular people have to use it, they say, okay, I'll provide a software or a service so that other developers might utilize. And it's just less of a hassle, because if they ask me a technical question, I can just answer it on the fly. So it would be much more easier for them to work with, let's say, other developers, because it's within their nature, than to actually just work with regular clients.
Yeah, I think that a lot of developer platform startups start that way. But inevitably, what you find is that in order for your API or developer platform to be successful as a business, you will need to figure out how to sell into companies and not just to individual developers. Like, a developer is often the implementer of your API or even an influencer in the purchasing decision, but they are not necessarily the one who controls the budget, right? The CTO might control the budget. And so you do have to figure out how to speak to those types of folks to be successful if you're building that kind of business. If you're building an open source tool, then you might not need to think about the business. You might just think about developers who are using it. And that can be a really fun route for a lot of developers. But, you know, that's different than building a developer tool business.
Yeah, even open source, you also have to focus on the business. So let's say Ghost, the open source blogging platform. I use it for doing the blog. It's an open source project. They also need to put a business plan on how to host and to put the subscribers on the platform. Yep. Even though if you want to think about it, it's an open source project, they still have to do the business plan to say if this is profitable or not. Some developers might think like, okay, I can just host a cluster for them and just call it a day. And Ghost took like the idea of, hey, how about you pay per subscriber, which is more business friendly.
I mean, yeah, and like monetizing open source is a whole area of focus that's gotten a lot of attention these days, right? Especially when you think about security vulnerabilities, like who's paying the maintainers to care about that or fix it? You know, is it just a hobby or is it something that they are able to focus on full time? There's some interesting models popping up here and there, but it's also a difficult problem to solve.
Yeah. MLH has collaborated with professionals from Fortune 500 companies, Big Four, and FANG companies. How have these partnerships influenced the skill development and career opportunities for aspiring software developers within the MLH community?
Yeah, so we think a lot around, like, we think a lot about what skills you need at a variety of different companies. Not every company is using the latest bleeding edge technology, right? Like there are companies that use a lot of Java. There are companies that use a lot of, you know, COBOL even, right? Even though that kind of sounds like an old language. And so we think a lot about how do we actually create opportunities for students to learn a variety of skills as well as new bleeding edge stuff so that they have access to a variety of different opportunities. You know, when you talk about Fortune 500s, there's a huge spectrum of technical adoption. You know, there are Fortune 500s that are incredibly tech savvy and modern and building, you know, microservices in the cloud, like whatever, you know, whatever the buzzword is. And there are Fortune 500s that still run mainframes. And we've run programs for students to learn mainframes. We've run programs for students to learn, you know, how do you run like a microservice like React app, you know, on AWS or something like that. And so we think it's our responsibility to expose students to a lot of these concepts and give them opportunities to learn them and let them choose for themselves what they're excited about. You know, like I've met people who love the idea of working on mainframes, and I've met people where all they want to touch is the latest, greatest technology. And that's okay, right? Like neither one is right or wrong. And we're not really in a position to decide that for someone, but we are in a position to expose them to as many concepts as possible so that they can, you know, make that choice.
Yeah. As the co-founder of MLH, what key skills or attributes do you believe are essential for individuals who aspire to become successful technical founders? How does MLH help cultivate these skills?
I think in order to be a successful founder, you have to care a lot about the problem space you are working in. Like myself and my co-founder Swift, both care very deeply about the problem space of helping developers and especially helping developers learn. Because that is something that we would be passionate about, whether or not we were working on MLH, it allows us to think about the big picture. It allows us to, frankly, like survive the ups and downs of running a startup. And it allows us to, you know, keep the company focused on our outcome, which is to empower hackers. I think where a lot of businesses struggle is people sometimes choose to work on a startup or business idea that they think will be lucrative, but that they don't necessarily care very much about. And that makes it difficult to persist through the bad times that you inevitably face as a founder. I think beyond that, like, having a co-founder that you can trust and depend on and see as a real peer makes an immense difference in how successful you're going to be, because no one else is going to understand as well as the two of you, or potentially three of you, what's going on and what the challenges are that you face existentially. And you probably are going to spend more time with your co-founder than anyone else in your life, at least in the early days of a startup. And knowing that you have trust, knowing that you have a strong working relationship, knowing that you can be friends, like, all of those things help to make a startup successful. And, you know, there's some stat I read that, like, most startups don't fail because of a failed business. They fail because of co-founders falling out with each other. And I think that's real. I think that, you know, it all comes back to, like, human interpersonal dynamics at the end of the day.
But at the end, how do I choose a good co-founder to be with? So you can be friends with some people. You might feel, let's say, a little bit close to some people, but they might not be good for the business. How am I able to assess if this person is good or not?
I mean, I think that working on projects together before starting a business together is a good way of feeling that out. Like, Swift and I spent a lot of time together organizing events, doing hackathon projects, coming up with crazy ideas together, you know, and seeing, you know, trying them out. And that gave us, like, a test bed for what it would be like to work together. But some of it is luck, you know, like, not all romantic relationships succeed, even if you think they're great. The same thing is true of business relationships. And you can't predict everything, but you can try and learn as much as possible before diving into a very long-term, you know, financial commitment with someone. And I've certainly seen situations where, you know, someone starts a business with a relative stranger and it works out. But I think that's the exception, not the rule.
I'm going to shift to a different question, which is, MLH has undergone a transition from an LLC to a C Corp to a B Corp. Can you discuss how these changes have impacted MLH's ability to achieve its mission and how the organization operates as a B Corp public?
When we started, when it was just Swift and I, we used an LLC because Swift already had the LLC for his consulting business. And so it was just an easy corporate entity for us to exist under. So it was purely convenience. There was no, like, strategic discussion of it. It was just the easiest path. We converted to a C Corp because we wanted to be able to give actual, like, equity grants to our team. And so that was the main thing. Like, LLCs don't really have, like, stock. They have ownership percentages and things like that, but it's a lot more complicated and less standardized. And so that was the main reason we converted to a C Corp. When we converted to a C Corp, we decided that we wanted to become a certified B Corp, which is a fairly in-depth certification that evaluates everything from your environmental impact to your societal impact to how you treat your team. Like, it covers everything and is really designed for companies that want to do good in the world while also building a business. That certification led us to becoming a public benefit corp, or PBC. So a C Corp is just a legal, like, tax designation. A public benefit corp is taxed exactly the same as a C Corp and effectively the same for 99% of situations. The big difference is that under Delaware state law, a public benefit corp can pursue impact and mission alongside profit. So sometimes you hear about shareholders, you know, battling a company because they felt like executives didn't make a good profit-oriented decision. In a B Corp, you have some protection against that, where we could say, hey, you know, we know that this is, we're turning down profit here, but we think that, you know, it's the right thing to do for our mission and community impact, And, you know, we have some protections to do that and care about that. And it really does allow you to build a different kind of impact-oriented business than you otherwise could. I think it's a great model. I honestly would love to see more companies doing it. Like now we're a public benefit corp and we're still B Corp certified as well.
So in the context of technology industry, you shifted towards B Corp. How does this transition to a B Corp inspire other organizations to prioritize social and environmental goals while still maintaining a focus of innovation and growth? So they might have this idea of growing the company and growing people around, but they just don't have this idea of why would I want to shift towards a B Corp? Why to do the transition?
I think that becoming a certified B Corp forced us to level up as a company earlier than most companies of a similar size. So what I mean by that is in the process, they evaluate things like, what does your supply chain look like? Like, are you using, you know, responsible vendors? Do you have parental leave policies? Do you have, you know, PTO and sick leave policies? Do you have equitable pay? You know, like things like that are part of the evaluation process. And when we did the initial certification, we were pretty small. We were like 5 or 10 people or something like that. And most 5 or 10 person companies don't have those kinds of policies and haven't even thought about them yet. And so it forced us to mature and grow and really level up, you know, our workplace at a relatively early stage. And I think that's been a huge benefit in hiring. I think it's forced us to, you know, build the business in a responsible way. And I think that it's given our community a lot of faith and certainty that we still care about them, even though this is a business, you know, like we frequently do things that are in the best interest of our community, but maybe are, you know, force us to grow slightly slower. But I think that's the right thing to do because their trust is probably the most valuable thing that we have.
So MLH emphasizes collaboration and teamwork in its hackathon. How can these experiences translate into valuable skills for software developers in their career, particularly when it comes to working efficiently in a team setting? So for example, if let's say I'm in a hackathon, I might join a team, I might learn doing things within a team. So how can MLH provide, let's say, like an experience that I could leverage this later on in a professional setting? Or in a job, let's say.
A lot of people call these like soft skills, which I think is maybe a misnomer, but in order to be successful in your career, you have to be able to see different perspectives and collaborate with people with a variety of different skill sets. You know, the old school sort of like archetype of a developer who like is in the code all day and doesn't talk to anyone doesn't exist anymore. Like those people are going the way of the dinosaur. And I think that's for the best, right? I think that, you know, that archetype limited who saw themselves as software developers and pursued that career path. Hackathons are a really unique environment to learn those like soft skills, because on a team at a hackathon, you might have front-end developers, back-end developers, designers, maybe non-technical people who are there to like work on your presentation or demo or whatever. And you're thinking through in a very short period of time what all of those people can do together to be successful, how each of them can contribute, and how you handle feedback and collaborative ideas around this problem that you're solving. And that's exactly what work is like. Like when you go work for a company, even if you're on a software engineering team, you're collaborating with a design team, you're collaborating with the product managers, you're getting feedback from random people, customers sometimes, and you have to be able to look at things from their perspective, consider how they view the world, and build that into your own work. I think it's incredibly important. And frankly, I think it's a competitive advantage. Like I think developers that are good at talking to people and considering other perspectives and collaborating, like, will do better in their careers and more likely go on to managerial or senior positions, because that's what a lot of those require to level up. And hackathons are like the perfect proving ground for that in terms of communication and collaboration.
So I'm going to move to a different question, which is MLH initiatives have a global reach. How does MLH address the cultural and societal nuance that comes with operating in different regions of the world? Can you provide examples of how MLH has adapted its program to cater diverse communities? And will it cater people from third world countries in the near future? So the idea of, let's say, expanding to other regions around the world.
Yep. So we have a couple of different offerings. We offer hackathons in something like 10 countries in person. So those countries are US, Canada, Mexico, UK, India, Singapore, Australia, and a handful of other mainland European countries. That is primarily a resource constraint. We like to have local staff who can attend the events. We like to have infrastructure in place to get things like swag or hardware or other materials that we think are going to be beneficial to the hackathons. And so there is physical infrastructure we have to build to, you know, support a new region like that. In order to make those events, you know, relevant for a local audience, a lot of it depends on local staff, right? Like me as someone living in New York, I'm not going to have a ton of insight into what it takes to throw a good hackathon in Bangalore, but our staff that live in Bangalore have a really good idea of that, you know? And so a lot of it is about getting people on the team who can understand the local tech community, understand the needs of students in those countries, and help us, you know, adapt our offering for different regions. Beyond the in-person events, though, we do a ton of online programming, like our virtual hackathons, which take place every weekend, Global Hack Week, which is a week-long hacker festival once a month, and our fellowship, which is a 12-week immersive training program. All of those are online. Anyone in the world can participate effectively. And, you know, we've done a lot of things to try and adapt them, like supporting different time zones is a big one. You know, having mentors who are from a lot of different regions, you know, having speakers from a lot of regions. All of these things make it feel more relatable and aspirational for students, regardless of where they live. And we frequently see people collaborating from a lot of different countries and places on single projects at those virtual events. I think it's one of the best parts of them is that you bring people together who might not otherwise meet in an in-person environment to get to work together and learn from each other and hopefully, you know, build something really cool together.
So I'm going to move to a different question, which is MLH organized workshops and events. How these activities contribute to the professional development of software developers and the cultivation of skills needed to be future dev evangelists? So if someone aims to become a dev evangelist.
So developer evangelists are typically programmers or people adjacent to programming who work to enable developer communities. Right. So things like writing docs, giving workshops, speaking at events, organizing Discord communities, like whatever it is, there's a lot of different responsibilities of developer evangelists. The people in our community who I think are best positioned for that type of role are often people who take on mentorship or leadership positions. So hackathon organizers, hackathon mentors, MLH coaches, which is our program where we, you know, pay students to represent MLH at hackathons all over the world. All of those types of things help you to learn the basic skills of working with developer communities, helping them be successful, and communicating in a language that they understand. And we see a lot of people, especially from the MLH coaches program, going off to become developer evangelists at companies in the industry, because it's a really transferable skill set. Like, going around to hackathons and speaking on stage and mentoring people is very transferable to talking to customers at a developer platform company. And so I think it's a really cool like way to get started in that career. And it was how I started my career. You know, it's a really interesting combination of coding and technical skills, as well as community facing work that is very human. Right? It's not just staring at a screen.
So So let's recap on the whole idea of developer evangelist. So the more I go to, let's say, hackathons, the more I speak with people, the more I'm capable of understanding how other people would understand and work, then it would put me in a better spot to be a developer evangelist because of my way of communicating with people, if you want to.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you basically got it right. Like, a lot of what makes a developer evangelist successful is empathy and understanding and the ability to translate technical concepts to a wide variety of audiences. And that is often what people learn from running or mentoring at or coaching at hackathons.
But what would be the difference between, let's say, an evangelist and developer relations in the case, since both of them do talk with people?
You're asking an age-old question. The difference is almost entirely semantic. Some companies call it developer evangelism. Some call it developer advocacy. Some call it developer marketing. Some call it developer relations. There's a million different titles for a very similar set of responsibilities. And a lot of it is just like what the company decides to call them. And, you know, there may be slight differences in job responsibilities, but like, it's not that different.
So I'm going to move to a different question, which is, MLH values the power of mentorship. How does MLH facilitate mentorship opportunities for student hackers, and how can mentorship contribute to the career growth? So if let's say, for example, there's mentorship opportunities, so I would ask someone at MLH, hey, can you set me up with a mentor? I need XYZ, or is there a different process for it?
We don't really run a facilitated mentorship program that's one-on-one like that. What we do instead is we reach out to alumni and more experienced hackers to come back to events as mentors. And you kind of touched on this earlier. You know, if you've done a lot of hackathons and gotten a lot out of them, and maybe, you know, you've won before and you're kind of less motivated by competition, how do you give back and stay involved in that community? You know, the answer is mentorship or becoming a leader. A lot of times that revolves around your alma mater, right? Like, where did you go to school? Sometimes, you know, people travel around and just help out at whatever local events exist. But we often are introducing mentors to events, telling them about events, and, you know, bringing them into our own virtual events to get involved. And I think it's one of the most, like, special parts of our community is that you have this, like, multi-generational support mechanism that, you know, people can stay connected to and continue to give back over the course of their career. Like, we've been around for 10 years now. There are people I talk to that are mentoring at hackathons or sponsoring hackathons now, and they were participating 10 years ago. Like, that's a really long time scale to stay involved with something. And I think it's really unique.
So you're saying that there's people who have been from the first hackathon from 10 years ago participating. It's like, it's so cool
mentoring
when you come
now
up and you
they're
see
not gonna
them
participate, but yeah.
Now imagine it's like seeing them. It's like, hi, hello there. That's kind of, I'm going to move to, do you want to continue on this?
No,
or?
Yeah.
I'm going to move to a different question, which is, MLH has likely encountered challenges along its journey. Can you share any specific obstacles or setbacks the organization have faced and how it has overcome them? What lessons can aspiring technical founders or any founder learn from MLH's experiences?
I mean, we've encountered a lot of challenges over 10 years. I think that one of the early challenges we face, which is actually kind of unique to MLH, is in how we communicated with our community. So in the early days of MLH, there was a high likelihood that Swift or I personally knew the local community leaders on different campuses. We quickly grew beyond that to a point where our community was too big for us to know everyone personally, but we still operated as if that was the case. And there's a level of like trust and understanding that exists when you know someone personally versus when you don't, and you see them as like a representative of an organization, right? That's kind of faceless. And, you know, we had to kind of transition our communication style from you're our friend and we know you personally to we are communicating with a mass audience that does not understand our implicit motivations or values. And so we need to be a lot more prescriptive around like how we see the world and what we care about and why we do the things we do in a way that, you know, people can understand even if they had never met us. And I think a lot of companies, even non-community focused companies, run into similar issues. Like, how do you communicate with your customers? How do you communicate with your team? How do you communicate with your end users? You know, all of those things change as the scale changes. And they're often like very difficult communication, like moments that companies go through where they have to figure that out for the first time. And so that was certainly a big obstacle we faced at this point many years ago, but you know, it was a big hurdle to jump over.
So I'm going to move to a completely different question, which is what initially sparked your interest in the world of hacking and technology, and how that passion eventually led to the creation of MLH? So you identify yourself mostly as like a hacker, someone who likes to tinker a lot.
I've always been interested in computers, like ever since I was a little kid. But when I went to college, I actually started out studying computer science and realized really quickly that I hated it. And it wasn't that I hated coding. I just didn't enjoy the academic parts of computer science. Like, I was not that interested in the efficiency of algorithms or whatever else. So I switched from computer science to history. And my goal was to become a high school history teacher. But what ended up happening is I took a semester off from school because I like got sick. And after I felt better, I needed something to occupy my time. And so I went on Craigslist and applied for random programming jobs in my parents' like small hometown in suburban New York. And it turned out that there was an edtech startup near my parents' house. It was probably the only startup in a 50-mile radius, but I applied for this job as a PHP programmer, and for some reason they hired me. And the people at that job were super interesting and like cool. And they actually started to drag me down to New York City to go to like meetups and hackathons. And I had this like moment where I was at this hackathon called Music Hack Day, where I was like looking around and I was like, oh, there's a lot of really interesting creative people here. There's musicians, there's artists, there's coders, there's all of these varied skill sets and interests and backgrounds, and they're all coming together to make cool stuff. That's what I love to do, right? Like that was what I enjoyed about coding. And so it made me realize that like tech wasn't all algorithms and sitting in a cubicle like Dilbert. You know, it was creative and people were passionate about it and there was community around it. And that was really what hooked me. And so I started going to hackathons like all the time. I started going to meetups all the time and just like engrossing myself in this tech community in New York. And that was what led me to becoming a developer evangelist, because I wanted to spend all of my time on those communities. And after doing that for many years, you know, Swift and I kind of agreed to quit our jobs to start a company together. He, through a whole chain of events, ended up quitting his job about 6 months before me. And in those 6 months, he started MLH to get back involved with a student hacker community that had a massive impact on his life. And at the time we were roommates. And so I was like peripherally involved in helping him out with stuff all the time. And eventually just like decided that this was something I cared a lot about and something that helped people. And so I quit my job to work on it with him. And, you know, now we're 10 years later.
So wait a second. So you were going to continue university as history. You didn't. You
decided. I did get a history degree, actually.
Oh, you do have a history degree.
Yeah.
It's like, but why? Like that's the question. It's like, why do you have a history degree if you're not gonna? Would it be like realistic if you did, let's say, computer engineering, or let's say something kind of related to doing something a little bit Harvard-like or something like that, or continue doing computer science, but then after you discovered the whole idea that coding is not just writing and doing stuff efficiently, like you can do something and you could just get a computer science degree. So you did the history degree, you went to the events, and you met Swift there at the events?
We met, I think after we graduated, when we, because I was a developer evangelist at this company, Twilio. He was at SendGrid doing the same thing. And so we went to a lot of the same events together and worked out of the same co-working space in New York. But in terms of like why I decided to actually finish my history degree, I thought history was really interesting. Like I enjoyed it. I enjoyed studying it. I enjoyed reading about it. I enjoyed doing the work. And so I just did it kind of for fun, which sounds silly in retrospect, but like I went to a state school in New York State. And so like, it wasn't super expensive. And I felt like this was an interesting thing to study. And I really just kind of got a lot out of it personally. And the whole time I was coding to make money through college, like that was my job while I was studying history. And I think I wasn't entirely sure what my career would be, but I knew that I was studying something interesting. I think that it has been surprisingly useful in the tech world. I think that the reading and analysis and writing skills that I developed doing a liberal arts major have been immensely helpful in developer evangelism, which requires a lot of communication. In starting a company, which requires a lot of writing and communication, like all of those things, I actually think gave me a leg up around people who had just studied computer science.
Yeah, I kind of realized knowledge work gives you a more accelerated way of doing things much more than software developers do. Look things in a different perspective when you're a knowledge worker than doing it in an analytical way, if you want to say.
Yeah, I mean, like liberal arts and math and science are somewhat different skill sets. I actually think that like more STEM majors should be required to take liberal arts classes to build that like foundation.
Yeah. As a co-founder, you likely have insights into the world of developer evangelism. Could you explain what developer evangelism means to you as specifically, and how does it align with the mission of MLH?
To me, developer evangelism is about helping other developers to be successful in accomplishing their own goals. It is a service role. That help can come in a lot of different ways. It could be literally helping them debug their code. It could be writing great documentation. It could be making sure your product team is, you know, creating a product that is a good experience for the developers using it. You know, it manifests in a lot of different ways. At MLH, we're not, you know, selling an API or a developer product of our own, but we're certainly introducing students to a lot of industry platforms that they might use one day, right? A big part of our model is like, we take industry platforms, you know, think a cloud platform or an API or something like that, and we help students use it for the first time. So that they understand what real world technologies and skills are, and they can bring that with them into the industry. Like a lot of our customers are developer relations teams who understand that like, if a developer has a really positive experience with your platform when they're a student, that when they go off into industry, they're likely to become a customer. And that could take a couple of years, but like, you know, having that positive sort of like long-term interaction is incredibly valuable. And a lot of that work and a lot of our best practices are informed by, you know, our backgrounds in developer evangelism.
So based on your experience at Twilio, you worked at Twilio as a developer evangelist. What skills and qualities do you think essential for someone pursuing a career in developer evangelism? Like, were there any programs, let's say, to accelerate people towards this specifically? So let's say there's coding boot camps for people who want to advance into computer science. Is there something similar to, let's say, developer evangelist, or would they have to go into the community and learn things?
When I worked there, there wasn't really that kind of like structured education. Like you know, my boss at the time, Rob, was a good mentor, right? Like he helped me level up a lot. My peers there helped me level up a lot, but there was no like boot camp to become a developer evangelist. Some companies have created ambassador programs or mini developer evangelism programs that serve that purpose. I think the MLH coaches program is one example of that. But I think that a lot of it just comes from like putting yourself in leadership positions in developer communities, right? We talked about this a little earlier, but running hackathons, running meetups, you know, giving talks at conferences are all ways to build that developer evangelism skill set and, you know, make that transition from a developer to a developer evangelist.
So I'm going to ask a different question, which is you're on a podcast called The State of Developer Education. Would you like to talk more about it? What does it serve? And would you like to share like previous experiences with, let's say, past guests that shared insightful information on the show?
Yeah, we started the State of Developer Education podcast last year. And I think we've put out something like 15 or 20 episodes at this point. The idea behind it was that in our work at MLH, we are on the front lines of how developers learn technical skills. We see the good, the bad, the ugly, everything in between. And I realized that a lot of people in our network, whether they're customers or friends or just influential educators, were doing really creative, interesting things to educate developers. And we wanted to talk to them and share their experiences with the world. So like some of the people we talked to are developer evangelists creating great documentation and onboarding resources. Some of the people we talked to are more traditional educators working on curriculum and, you know, like standards for the classroom. You know, I find it fascinating to hear like how individuals got started and how that informs their own approach to educating other developers. You often see that like how someone learned to code or what their experiences were like in school, you know, have pretty drastically shaped their opinions of how they should serve other people. But it's been a really great experience. We've talked to a lot of really fascinating people, and you know, I definitely would encourage people to check it out and subscribe because we have a lot more episodes coming out. We release them one a week at this point.
Yeah. I'm going to ask a different question, which is at a certain stage in life, you might find out that you've hit a certain plateau. Certain people might resolve towards, let's say, changing jobs or resolve towards creating their own startup in which they have, let's say, a product or they offer consultancy services. Or they might resolve to, let's say, work with different startups and help existing startups to mature. Certain people might head towards, let's say, doing something they want to have an adventure. Others might play it safe and just stay in a corporate job because it's secure. The outcomes are kind of expected. Would you consider this path in the late future? Elaborate on this if you want to consider it. So let's say you've hit a specific plateau in life where you just realize like things not moving forward or backwards, and like that's it, you've hit the slope, and you realize, okay, I might do a new startup, or I might become a yogi, or I might teach people how to do snowboarding. Would you consider doing this in the future or not?
I mean, I don't have any intentions of leaving MLH at the moment. I think that what you're describing is a really natural reaction of people when they're in a time of change. And I actually think it's a really healthy thing. I think that like pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone and trying something drastically different is a really powerful learning and growth experience. Like, you know, I you know, am not intending to leave MLH, but like I certainly do a lot of things where they are really outside of my comfort zone, whether that's in work or outside of work. Like last year I went on a TV show to compete as a baker, you know, like that has nothing to do with tech, has nothing to do with like anything in my professional life. I don't really intend to become a baker ever professionally, but that was like a totally different experience that helped me grow in different weird ways. And at MLH, like I find opportunities like that all the time. Like anytime we're launching a new product or figuring out a new direction or some new tactic to try, you know, I can help shape that and learn as we go.
So Speaking about entering the removing from the comfort zone, or entering in a way where you don't know where you're going, certain people like myself, who let's say want to create their own startup, side project, or anything they want to represent, but they're afraid to take a leap forward due to the fact that creating your own startup is not an easy thing, but the fact they don't know what they're heading towards, aka towards the unknown. That fear might cripple them from moving forward by taking a leap forward to the unknown. You might have more insights on this in terms that you've experienced something similar, or you've seen people around you in MLH grow, but you realize certain people didn't move forward due to fear. Would you like to talk more about this? So let's say you might see someone who took the leap, moved forward and advanced, while someone else might say, I might not be comfortable doing this, and they didn't do anything.
So I think it's okay to be afraid of starting a startup. It is a massive risk and financial commitment. And that's not to say you shouldn't do it, but it's not the right path for everyone. And frankly, it requires a lot of resources and privilege to be able to do it, right? Like, I remember the early days of MLH when we weren't making any money, you know, my bank account was just like dwindling every month. Like, I didn't have a lot of money to fall back on. And that's a huge risk, right? And not, I was lucky enough that I had like even a little bit of savings to be able to do that. But like, if we had gone more than a year without making any money, like I would have gone broke, you know? And so the way that we solved that problem for ourselves was focusing early on revenue, right? So that we could pay our rent. But like, not everyone has that luxury. So what do I mean by that? Like, I think that the best way to start most startups, if you don't have a ton of resources at your disposal, is to do them as a side project first. And once you get traction, and once you have found a kind of like found that spark of like product market fit, that is perhaps the time where you should consider transitioning full time to it, or even raising money to de-risk it for yourself a little bit. You know, the safest way to start a startup is if you already have a job and work on it on the side. And, you know, I think that it's okay to be afraid of it. I think that is really scary, and it's, you know, high likelihood of failure. But on the other hand, it's one of the most intense sort of compressed ways to grow professionally that I've ever seen. And so I think it's a worthwhile risk, but it needs to be a calculated risk.
So I always end the podcast with a mental health question, something that I always do, which is, have you ever faced burnout or imposter syndrome? And if you did, what did you do to resolve these?
Every day I face imposter syndrome, and certainly I face burnout many times in my life. I think that for burnout, you know, a lot of it is about like what recharges you personally. For me, it's been different things at different points in my life. Sometimes the way I deal with burnout is like, I can't be on Zoom all day anymore, so I need to go to a hackathon and interact with people in person. Like, that has been something that's worked for me in the past. Sometimes it's, I need to go on vacation and just get away from work for a little bit. Sometimes it's as simple as like, I need to go take my dog for a walk and like, you know, listen to a podcast, right? Like, it really depends on what recharges you personally. But I think it's a really natural thing that people face. In terms of imposter syndrome, I mean, I run our sales team at MLH. You know, I think I've gotten pretty good at it over the years. I've been doing it for 10 years now, but I had never worked in a sales role before we started. I kind of fell into it out of necessity. And, you know, like every day I'm like, wow, like I didn't think about that. Like, I didn't know you were supposed to do things that way. And that manifests in so many different areas in a startup. Like, the first time you have to do a managerial review, you're like, oh, there's no template for this. No one tells you how to do this. Like, how do you learn how to do this? And I think that the only way you overcome it is by having a good support network, and by, you know, trusting your gut and being open to feedback. Like, no one does this alone. even solo founders often have people giving them tons of feedback and support. And I think that that is necessary for finding any level of success in, you know, startups.
But how do you know, let's say, the type of feedback that you're receiving is a good kind of feedback or a bad kind of feedback? So some people might take feedback personally, while the other person might be just aiming to help them.
There are a lot of founders out there that have big egos. I have found the opposite to be beneficial, that like your ego needs to be as small and humble as possible in a certain way so that you can consider a lot of feedback. Because people like, I don't know, like sometimes you get reactions to what you are working on that like don't feel good, right? Or feel dismissive or feel, you know, I don't know, like attacky. You have to be able to weather that and power through, right? And so I think having conviction in your idea and your mission is different than taking things personally. Like if someone told me hackers aren't important, you shouldn't care about hackers, they're not meaningful to work on, I would have a big problem with that. You know, if someone told me, hey, like, I think that the way you are going about, like, I think that the way you're running your workshop, you know, isn't the most effective, like, great, like, I want to hear that feedback. And so you have to be able to separate the big picture things from like, what do I need to have conviction in our impact and goals as an organization, to the tactical things of, am I doing the, like, specific parts of the work in the best possible way? And that's something that I think people should always be open to feedback about. Because that's what helps you grow, right? Like, I remember when I was at Twilio, I thought I was a pretty decent writer. But like, when I used to send my blog posts around to the team, they would submit hundreds of edits back to improve them. And I learned a ton through that process. And if I had said, I'm too good, I don't trust your feedback, I never would have learned anything.
Thank you so much for listening to the episode. If you liked it, then feel free to watch our previous episodes and feel free to follow us on social media and rate us on your favorite podcast app of choice.